Welcome to Paper Money, the biweekly podcast covering the business side of the game industry. From Uno to Underground, from Mattel to Mayfair. I'm Ben Clark.
And I'm Rhett Kipp.
Today is April 25th, 2011.
Woohoo! We actually got our show on the right day.
I know, I was very excited. And anytime you get to work in Mayfair's old Underground RPG, that's a good day. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think you can still, if you go to the shows, you can probably still find the, like, underground, you know, all the modules, like, shrink-wrapped together for, like, a dollar. So, in fact,
I suspect there's probably some in our sales area.
Go to the Mayfair booth, speak to Bob McCarty, and say, I'd like all of the underground modules for a dollar, please. So, actually, I do think they got rid of them finally. They sold them off to somebody. But anyways, I'm Ben Clark. Today's April 25th, 2011. How you doing, Red?
I'm doing pretty good. Post-Easter, you know, I'm not OD'd on chocolate.
Maybe that's why I'm talking this way, is that I am. We have a fun show this week, and we'll I'll do our show preview here. Corrections, none that we know of, and largely because I ignored my email. News, no, we're not going to bother with any news. Guest, no, we're not going to do a guest. Commentary. Yes, we are going to do commentary. And we do have, we're going to talk about games that we love. Okay. We always talk about the business side of games. In a minute, we're going to talk about just games that we really, really like. And, but before we do that, we have a lot of listener mail this week. So I want to do that first. And our first email is a little interesting. Now, Rhett, I'm going to read it, and then you can decide if we're actually going to try and answer it or not. I think this might be one that we throw off to the guys at RPGNow.com or something. But
I think we can answer it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, all right. I think it might be a short answer, too. Laz the Infamous asks, I have just a general question, but you guys would probably be the best source of information. And this is a little odd because it is about torrents. I'm assuming he means BitTorrents. Has anyone done anything besides cease and desists for defunct RPGs? I'm looking at bigger games like WEG's West End Games Star Wars or older versions of D&D. The license or company that produced them is still active, but I haven't heard anything about anyone being prosecuted for this type of thing. You hear about it for movies and music, but not so much anything else. The reason I'm asking is because the WotC version of Star Wars is about to go defunct, which would create even less reason to get a newer RPG. Rhett, go for it.
Well, this is an easy one. The answer is grab yourself with both hands, because while they may not have prosecuted, they certainly can at any time. Cease and desist is a constant. It's out there all the time because you must protect your license. If you don't protect your license, then what will happen is some of the big kids will come up and take it over for you, and it will become part of the public domain. So they will protect it. And I guess it would come down to what you think you were doing. Most important, why you could use the system, let's say, for Star Wars RPG. Heaven forbid that you use any of the Star Wars stuff or Lucasfilms and its very, very large army of lawyers will be knocking on your door.
You'll have stormtroopers carrying briefcases marching right up into your server-laden bedroom.
George and the Emperor have a lot of similarities.
Yeah, the reason – now, he talks, too, about WotC, and honestly, here's another company that here's how this works. Don't screw with anyone who has money, right? I mean –
Absolutely.
I mean, that's okay. A lot of old war games have actually come out where there are online modules for Vassal and things like that, and the rules are out there in their entirety because no one's enforcing the copyright. Even then, I would say it's dicey as to whether or not I want to go out on a limb and use any of the original art.
Yeah, a lot of different elements are protected, and they're controlled by different people. They're not actually necessarily controlled by the manufacturer. They could be controlled by the artist. They could be controlled by the original writer. A lot of rights revert depending on contracts and how all of it's set up in the first place. TSR is not a place to go screwing around with your old stuff, because most of TSR stuff, for example, is actually owned by the writers and artists. They all revert back.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, and as someone who works in the industry, I really do like it when we try and keep all this stuff above board. Yeah. Because honestly, if it's a small enough industry that, you know, it's nice to get paid. You know, nobody's making any real money anyway. But Laz, in answer to your question, can you slide under the radar? Maybe, probably. Do you want to be the guy who gets gigged? No. I really would stay away from any game that has made money ever. Seriously.
Yeah,
if you're going to do this, you know, maybe Tales of the Floating Vagabond. oh wait, no, that's on rpgnow.com. Somebody, it is. Their rights have been picked up by somebody. So, there are titles that you can legally do this with. I don't know that I would dink about with Star Wars in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think it's a bad choice in so many levels. And not only that, the deal is that license is going to be back in part of someone else's network soon.
Yeah, who will then, and they'll, you know, sue you.
So. And they'll get mad about it as well. And even again, if you leave off the Star Wars part of it and you just go with the Saga system, the Saga is third edition D&D. You will be playing with fire there. They are not a happy group of campers over at WotC.
No. That's because it rains all the time in the Northwest. But let's move on. Laz, it was an interesting question, and I do want to actually get with someone who knows more on this stuff at some point. So we might actually revisit this in a future show. But right now, Dave Rosser taunts, photos or it didn't happen. Smiley face. I'm assuming he's talking about some of the amazing scenery we saw, or you saw, at Little Wars.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dave. You really kind of, that was...
As a matter of fact...
We're an audio podcast, Dave. Even if we had photos, we just hold them up to the mic to no effect.
I was going to say, I'm holding them here right now so you can see them through my recording device. There are a number of sites, if you're really interested in finding them. There are a number of sites, and one that I will absolutely say, if you're into terrain, and that'll tie up with one of our future letters here, there's just an amazing set out there for Gallipoli from Salute. And basically, if anybody out there is interested in miniature gaming and terrain, go find it. I'm done.
Gallipoli Terrain by Salute.
For the Salute 2011, it's the... Oh. British show that just happened a week ago.
Okay. All right. So go Google that, my friends, and supply your own pictures. Or more to the point, Mr. Dave Rosser. hey, speaking of letters, we didn't get a letter this week, but I wanted to apologize. Last week, we had one guy who got the Jim Baker joke that I made, and then I teased him for misspelling Jim Baker in the email. And so I wanted to apologize. One, I was very excited that he got the joke. I didn't mean to, in fact, impugn his spelling. So if we're going to make obscure references and have people write in that they got them, I did want to apologize that I was being rude by making fun of his spelling. But, you know, grammar's important.
I will never make fun of anyone's spelling, as you know.
Oh, my God, right. I've gotten emails from you where the spelling was so bad it meant something completely different.
Isn't it amazing?
Yes. Yes, it does.
It's a gift.
It really is amazing. But I digress. A gentleman by the name of Mike queries the following. Hey guys, I've been listening to the show for a few months and wanted to let you know, you can never have too many details for me. I don't design games, but I found the card conversation really interesting. Really, I did. Smiley face. You two have a good, seem like a good place to inquire about something I have been considering from a production standpoint. I make hand-cut modular boards for miniature gaming, and I have considered the possibility of having boards manufactured in plastic, polyurethane, or similar, as hand-cutting flush square sides is quite tedious, as you can imagine. Now, he sent us a link to some of the pictures he does, and all I have to say is, wow, it's beautiful stuff.
Unbelievably. That is just... fabulous stuff there.
Yeah. Mike, actually, I think we're going to put, we'll have to, speaking of photos, we're going to have to put his, the link he sent us in the show notes. Mike, judging from the detail, and what we're talking about here, folks, is if you've ever seen big miniatures boards that are done in, say, 2-foot by 4-foot sections, and then all mounted together to make one gigantic train. Usually you see this at tournaments and stuff like that. This is the kind of stuff that Mike's talking about. It is so beautiful. It puts most model railroad layouts to shame. And I have to say, you're not going to be able to produce this, Mike. And the reason is, a mold for the polyurethane to form that is going to be hideously expensive. To give you an idea of what polyurethane molds cost, in China, right, is in the U.S., you multiply this by about four or five. In China, to get, say, a set of anywhere from, you know, call it 5 to 10 custom 25-millimeter size, you know, figures stamped out of plastic, you're looking at about anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 for the mold cost, depending on how many different colors you want, whether it's a large or a small mold. Sometimes it's more cost-effective to use a small mold, depending on the size you run or not. But you're looking at $3,000 to $5,000, and that's actually, you know what, $3,000 to $5,000 for a 10x10 vacuum-formed tray mold. There, that's I think that's probably the best analogy here. That's here in the States by a great company called, I think, Plastic Ingenuity. I want to say they're in Wisconsin. But their cost on a big mold for something like that is about, I want to say it's about $5,000. And that's a 10 by 10 piece. Now, 2 feet by 4 feet, that's going to be expensive. By the way, a 10 by 10 vacuum form plastic, like you see in the bottom of a game tray, figure if you're going to do 1,000 of them, you're looking at anywhere from $1 to $1.50. It's been a while since I've had to quote one. Again, that's U.S. manufacturer. So again, a 2 foot by 4 foot piece might just be beyond the pale for most people to even manufacture. And then we get down to the fact that we're talking about beautiful miniatures terrain, which, as Rhett will tell you,
is expensive.
Well, it's expensive because you can't, not that many people want it, right? To get your money back on this.
Oh, you're talking, yes. It's very limited in market. There's some amazing companies out there who do buildings, and buildings have a more universal appeal to them. And yet, it's very difficult to make a livelihood out of that. Miniature Building Authority does okay.
Do you remember, was it Geohex, right?
Geohex, yeah.
I mean, that was the upscale terrain of its time. I had a ton of it that I bought at 50% off because I worked at a game distributor. Thank you very much. And when I sold it, it was going for way above retail because they had gone out of business and you couldn't get it anymore. And it was modular terrain. It was really great stuff. But he had to make all of it by hand.
Right. It was all custom jig cut.
Yeah. It was just too much to do. So anyways, so my guess on this is that I would try and find a way to automate my production or make it as simple as, you know, possible in the long run. But realistically, there's almost no way you're going to be able to go to production and have someone produce something like this for you. Right. Unless you smallify your terrain or uglify your terrain.
Yeah,
or manage to sell,
I think it's probably
units
economically outside of most people's means to acquire. And again, I don't think the market's large enough to do much with it. Gale Force 9 is a great example of someone who worked along those lines.
The soft plastic terrain, right? Is that Gale Force doing this, like the soft rubber terrain?
No, Gale Force does a resin, a lot of stuff. They're now owned by Battlefront.
Oh, okay.
But before they were owned by Battlefront, they still did a lot of custom stuff. And they were doing custom terrain boards for the industry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had plenty of tools to work with. As a matter of fact, if you're ever at a show and you have a question about the terrain end of the industry, speak to the owners of Gale Force, the old owners of Gale Force. They're still there. They will highly enlighten you. It's a wonderful thing they do. They're very excited to talk, generally speaking, to anybody about the manufacturing end of stuff. But it's uneconomical. They could not actually continue to make a living at that. They ended up, you know, finding ways to make.
They're one of the more
products
adaptable
that had
companies.
More viability to them.
They've done some neat stuff filling in niches, I would have to say. So Rhett says, talk to Gale Force 9, who is always at Gen Con and is probably also going to be at Origins this summer. So, Mike, if you're in the neighborhood on either of those shows, good place to go. And speaking of shows, our last letter from last week, this is from Mr. Wally Harwood, who demands, hello, although he's from Canada, eh? So it's probably hello. today, I lost myself. I said A and immediately just... Whew, today I listened to the most recent episode on my commute to work, and damn, it was good. As someone who will most likely have cards printed eventually, it provided me with a lot of info. One request, though. As a Canadian, do you have any info on Canadian shows, preferably in Western Canada? Just wanted to say thank you for putting in all the work for the podcast. They're always very informative, and the two of you are a lot of fun to listen to. Have a great Easter weekend. Well, thank you, Wally. Just for that last paragraph, we're going to answer your question. I have no idea if there's any shows in Canada.
My guess is if there are shows in Canada, especially in Western Canada, you're probably looking along the coast. I'd say Vancouver, yeah, Vancouver Island.
Canada has this problem in general that pretty much all the Western U.S. has as well, which is that you have a couple of big cities where there's gamer action, so to speak. But outside of Vancouver, and I'm assuming Alberta, unless that's a province, in which case I just grossly embarrass myself. But the big cities are probably going to have something. The best way to find this is going to be online. And I know there's some stuff in Toronto. There is actually a Canadian game distributor, Lion Rampant. I think they're still around. Who might have details on some of that stuff. But Wally, I apologize. I used to actually try and keep a database. This is about 8 years ago. I used to actually try and keep a database of every single gaming show that I knew about in the world, right? And I have not updated that database in about 8 years, but I don't know. This is one where Google's going to be your friend. And our listeners, by the way, listeners, if we have anybody in Canada or Western Canada, let us know what shows are out there, because we always talk about the big U.S. shows and the German shows, but let us know if there's anything in Canada.
Yeah. I was going to say, because the only shows I've known in Canada are relatively moderate size game conventions, and they're all on the east.
Yeah.
Or I shouldn't say in the east.
Well, that's where the population's denser. I mean, that's why if you look at the U.S. show for games, out west you have Gamma Trade Show in Vegas. You have one or two clustered around L.A., San Diego. I think there's a decent show in San Francisco now.
There's a really nice show up in Seattle.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Surprise, yeah. Given all the people that live in Seattle.
Exactly. But you know, okay, so, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's something in Denver. But like I said, that leaves most, well, and there's, well, BGG.com is now in Dallas.
Yeah, well,
but again,
you know,
this is a huge geographic region, and we're still ignoring basically the entire upper Midwest, and they have to hoof it into Indianapolis as the closest big show, or maybe Adepticon in Chicago. So,
yeah, you know, even places like Wisconsin and Minnesota, which have really large gaming communities, don't have really big shows. They have a couple of nice sized shows, but they don't have any really big shows.
Yes, exactly. So, anyways, so I apologize about that. Like I said, if I were encyclopedic in my knowledge of this stuff, I'd still be living in my parents' basement and be building Starship Enterprise models.
You mean you're not?
No, I apologize. I love games, but anyways, I can't know everything. So, that said, let's talk about games. I was... the other night, it was Saturday night before Easter, and I was sitting around the table playing Mad Zeppelin with my son and my daughter, ages 11 and 9. And it was fun. And it occurred to me, this is why I'm in the game industry, because it's fun. We, you know, everybody's underpaid. There's always flack. If we wanted to make a ton of money, we all should have gone into finance with the way we can calculate percentages based on to hit rolls. But instead, we're all in the game industry, and that's because it's fun. So, Rhett, I just wanted to talk about our favorite games. Now, you and I allude to our favorite games a lot of the times, but it, you know, we're not going to say, you know, these are not acclaimed as the best in the industry per se. These are ones that Rhett and I love. These are the games that we play because we absolutely love these games. And we just wanted
this is
to,
a personal choice,
yeah,
as opposed
is, yeah,
to the overall
yeah.
best hyper bowl. You know, everybody should play this game.
Yes. So, Rhett, I know there's one game that you and I can agree on, and we won't go on for forever and ever. But I just want to give an example, and that's Blood Bowl. Third edition.
Yes.
The new fifth edition rules are absolutely outstanding. They're available for online download. But Blood Bowl third edition was just. What a wonderful game.
Yeah, it's amazing It was
like,
you know, yeah,
it was like football, but it wasn't. It was fantasy. It was miniatures, but you didn't have to be that good. All you had to do was paint guys to look like a football team, and you only had to paint 11 of them.
Yeah, I mean, it was a limited quantity, which is why Workshop in particular doesn't like the product.
Yes.
You know, it was very compact. You could buy almost everything with no issues whatsoever, and, you know, carry it around with you.
Yep.
And it offered a lot of advantages simply because it was very social.
Yes.
You know, like fantasy football.
Except when you and I played, because you and I would always come down to the last dice roll.
But it was still social.
Oh, it was very social.
People convinced about it and watched us, you know, bicker with one another.
And, you know, here's the thing. It is the best league game I've ever played, right? You and I have both, I think, said this. There's a huge amount of depth when you add the Death Zone expansion. And again, I think that's all built into 5th edition now. But I remember just weeks going by where, you know, we didn't play the game for 2 weeks, but we trash talked email, you know, every day, 5 times a day, you know, I remember my team was sending out press releases. And anyway, suffice to say, Blood Bowl, Rhett and I absolutely, this is one of our favorite games ever. So Rhett, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say absolutely. And it's one of the games that I think is really popular inside the industry. I know I played in a Fossil League. I know that there's a league locally here that I get to participate in on occasion. I know that there's a few other manufacturers out there who have internal leagues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's again, if you don't play, at least give it a read through.
Yes. If you're going to read through it, though, read through the 5th edition rules. Jervis Johnson, wonderful, wonderful designer. I still think there's some editing issues in the 3rd edition. But by the way, the PC version of it was just on sale on Steam for $9.99. Okay, and unlike the version that came out in the 90s, for those of you who are old like me and Rhett and remember it, it's not terrible. It's actually pretty cool. It captures most of the flavor of the game, some of the flavor. It doesn't suck. How's that? But for $10... You know,
it really could be not a lot bad,
yeah,
for $10.
Yeah, it's PC only, so if you're a Mac guy like me, you got to run it in Parallels. But anyway, so what's another game that you absolutely love that makes you go, this is why I'm in this industry?
I'd say the original Avalon Hill Civilization, one of my absolutely...
Civilization or Advanced Civilization?
You know, really either one of them. I think they're close enough to each other.
Yeah. I'd say Advanced Civ is... Really, but yeah, I know what you mean. Go ahead.
It added enough to it. To me, the big advantage that it added to it was giving multiple cards so that you could trade up throughout the levels.
Yes.
But some of the other play I thought was a little, you know, six of one, half dozen of another, as far as some of the other trade offs were concerned.
But really, I that's one that I'll play every few years at a convention. But you really, really love that game.
I do. I love the game. It's a lifestyle game. You know, you have to be dedicated to play it, not because it's that complicated a system to learn. It just takes a really long time to play it.
That's why especially I only play it every 2 years, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, especially with the group of people I play with, because everybody is constantly making deals to get me.
Well, you know, our good friend and listener, Mr. Dan Glovier, people have actually written like theses about him playing his online diplomacy play, because they were targeting Dan so badly at one point because he was such an avid player. But you know, I love Civilization. It's a great game. It's a really long game. It's definitely old school.
Absolutely.
But it's such a rewarding experience if you get 8 people around that table. And start at, I remember doing this, I think we started at 6 o'clock, and they threw us out of the convention hall at 2:30, and we were maybe, I don't think we were even halfway done with the game.
It's a game that's at least 8 hours.
Yes, if you play fast, and you're not playing with a full 8 players.
Yeah.
But it's a great game. It really doesn't matter. It's a worthwhile experience to play. All right, speaking of old school, actually, let's switch gears for a second. One of my all-time favorites... And I don't know if you're going to agree with this one or not, is Dominion. The original Dominion, the expansions, as with all expansions, I think you hit a point of diminishing returns and for the complexity. But the original Dominion, I have yet to play a game of that I didn't absolutely have a great time.
You know, I can't comment on it because, well, I know how it's played. I've never actually played the game.
Okay, all right.
Me and two other people, I know.
But it's that kind of new thing, right? Here's somebody who said, I love deck building, but I don't want to spend $500.
Yeah.
So I'm going to build the deck building into the game. And then actually, now Dominion has been criticized as a mechanic in search of a game. I disagree. I really think that it's a good game. It's a great game. I know that I have all the expansions, haven't even had a chance to play the last two yet, but it doesn't matter. They're not going anywhere, ever. I really like that game, and I like how it changes from game to game, and that's something that, you know, it's simple enough that my 11-year-old's actually pretty good at it. But it changes all the time, and that's what I love about it. So
yeah.
I'll keep playing Dominion long after it's gone out of style. That's another one of my favorites.
Yeah.
All right, Reds.
I was going to say, you know, one of my absolute favorite games, and again, an older game but not old school game, Citadels. I love Citadels. Great multiplayer game. Constantly having to think ahead. Very simple mechanisms.
Did you have to think ahead two, even three turns?
Two, three turns, and you have to figure out what everybody else on the table is trying to accomplish.
Yeah. And I haven't played Citadels. What's the brief on that? Who published it? When did it come out?
It's a Fantasy Flight game. I believe it's probably about 8 years ago.
Okay.
It's a multiplayer game, and effectively each turn, every player has the option of taking some kind of a title, which gives you a specific action mm-hmm. that you can accomplish. And the deck passes around. There's always more cards for players than there are players at the table, so you never know what anybody's going to take. And a lot of things interact, so a thief can only steal from one person. It always steals from not a player, but a title. So you kind of have to figure out if you're going to take that and you're going to screw someone over, are you going to screw someone over that you want to screw over?
Yeah.
It's simply a matter of accumulating points. You're building a little city. Mm-hmm. And, you have advantages. Sometimes it makes it less expensive to make buildings. Sometimes it allows you to collect more revenue than you would. Sometimes it allows you to knock someone's building down. There's all sorts of choices that you get to make. And as I say, it's this whole interaction and trying to figure out what everybody else at the table is trying to accomplish. And, you know, skewing your strategy based off of not just what you want to do, but what you think other people are trying to do to you. And so it's a very simple system, though.
See, and I think that's a hallmark of some of the better games, is that the system might have it doesn't have a ton of moving parts. So even if you have, like, Civilization is a classic example. There's several subsystems, but nothing overly complex.
Right.
You know, the entirety of combat is you remove one, I remove one, until there's none left.
Yeah.
I mean, that's and I think that's. It's one of those things where it's simple enough that you can explain that you can outline it to somebody in 5 minutes and get them going. And by the end of the first turn, they're mostly going, aha.
Well, in the trading game, which, you know, it appears in a number of other game systems. It's a similar trading system to that in Settlers, you know, where you're.
See, I'm trying to figure out if I should say Settlers. Settlers is a game that I really, really, really enjoy every time I play. But I don't know if it's the magical one for me compared to the way it is for some people.
Well, you know, Settlers is one of those games that, as you recall, the old sales staff where we used to work played it every day for lunch.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where we found out some odd things about Settlers. Specifically about seating arrangement.
Yes, and I've talked to the guys at Mayfair, and they say that at the tournaments that doesn't necessarily happen. So I don't know. But anyways, and you know the board game that really turned me on to Euros though was Serenissima from Eurogames.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen this one? It's a fairly large game, for at least for the time. I mean, it had all these. Basically, it's a Mediterranean trading and possible combat game, although combat isn't profitable. So. If you're all a bunch of gamers around the table, you say, okay, we're not going to attack each other, right? But it was a really great little game. You had these little, you know, little brown plastic, you know, tire triremes running around the Mediterranean trying to collect cargo. You know, pure economic sim for the most part. And it was a blast. And
yeah.
When it first came out, again, it's a Euro Games title, which came out in their same – the same collection really as Formula Day. They came out, they released a bunch at the same time, and it was, I absolutely fell in love with it. I don't even know if you can find it anymore. I think it's definitely out of print. Formula Day came back, but that one never did. Absolutely fell in love with it. It was one of those things where it really, for me, that was the gateway into all the other European games. So yeah. I really, really, really loved it.
Yeah. I was going to say there's a lot of I'm not the biggest fan of the Euro games, oddly enough, which is strange knowing my general gaming style, you'd expect that I am. But I, you know, anybody who knows me knows that my big argument is I want to play with toys. I'm a big fan of like all the Richard Broad variant of designs of Battle Cry and Modern War 44 and Battle Lore.
Okay, all right, that's cool. They're not, you know,
et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Where Axis and Allies, you know, if you put toys on the board, it makes it a better board game.
Axis and Allies, that's a big fave. But see, I'm a squad leader player. That fact, actually, the original squad leader is definitely one of my all-time favorites. I know it's old school. I know it's a lot of fun to make fun of it. And certainly Advanced Squad Leader is complex to the nth degree. but the neat thing was it was a scale you could get, right? It was a guy with leading a squad, okay? It wasn't this abstract 1-to-10 ratio like so many of the miniatures games. It was a map you could understand. That house represents a house. And it was a hoot and a half. And you could set it up in a half an hour and play it in four. And, I would go over to Jim Dixon's basement, or he'd come over to mine, and we'd kill a Saturday afternoon playing, you know, the Road to Wilts. Or actually, that one takes a little bit longer than 4 hours. But it was an absolute great game. That was my gateway game for historicals. And now since then, it's gone out of print, and it's Advanced Squad Leader is much more complicated, and they can't quite seem to keep that one in print. But the magic for me is still there. I still love to get all the scenario packs. I don't even know. I haven't even played any new scenarios in a year.
I was going to say, you know, but they keep coming out with new stuff all the time.
I buy them just to read the scenarios and see how go, okay, so this guy's got a heavy and a good leader, but that guy's got like 57 Russian squads. Maybe, you know.
One of the things I always liked about the way that game in particular set out its scenarios, which became a trend in later games, is it had the little historical perspective of what it was the game was about.
Yes.
Had the game. And then it had the historical result.
Yes, to the aftermath.
I think it was one of the very first games that actually had done anything along those lines.
You know what's interesting, though, is one of the best squad leader scenarios ever, okay? And if there are squad leader people out there who may argue about this, is Hill 621.
Yeah.
And Hill 621 is based on a much larger scale battle that happened. It actually happened on the Russian front, but it never happened on the scale that it happens in the game. And it's absolutely a fantastic, just a hoot and a half. Everybody gets to attack. Everyone gets to defend. It's a great scenario, but it's not necessarily historically accurate. And that has become kind of the buzzword on a lot of these scenario based games, even with the geomorphic board, even with, you know, all these other things, people really want you to go back to the source and say, show me where this conflict happened. Hill 621 doesn't do that. It's still a great, great game. So anyways, the squad leader, I absolutely love. Your turn. Hit me.
I'll go back to a pair of classics, which I compared to each other, though they're really different in overall effect. Starfleet Battles and BattleTech.
You know, I was thinking about both of those classic
old games.
And I love BattleTech. I have not played Starfleet Battles since I think it was before Reagan was shot. Might have been right after that. I mean, but it made such an impression because I got to blow up my dreadnought and take the Klingon out with me. It was a great time. You know, we were probably in eighth grade. It was a hoot and a half. And BattleTech is kind of the same way in that it's there's a little more paperwork involved than what you would call a modern design, but I think it's a blast. And the BattleTech universe is so great.
Well, and that,
I mean,
that's
how many
what
of us
think...
just read the source books for anything, right? You know, we don't. You know, you never use half the stuff in a source book in a game. You just like reading it. And the BattleTech universe, I absolutely love.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as most people know that have been listening to our show, I still am waiting for the universe to come out. It's the piece de resistance. It's been promised to me for, you know, close to 14 years now. So I'm waiting still with bated breath.
So now, All right, we haven't done any yet. I was thinking about role playing games, and I really love AD&D Second Edition. All right, okay. I know.
I'll give it to you. I'm close on that. I actually like the original D&D.
Okay. Wait, the three booklets or?
The three booklets. Okay. You know, I am really old school.
No, you're just old, man. You start.
Yeah, well, there's that too.
No, but AD&D Second Edition with the guy prying the jewel out of the demon's eye, demon statue's eye, or even the next batch that they did in the mid-90s to kind of clean them up a little bit. You know, but I was thinking, you know what I like better? Deadlands. Deadlands.
What's that? Which one?
Deadlands. The original Deadlands, yeah, with the poker chips and the cards and zombies and six shooters. Absolutely fell in love with the universe. And I thought the thing that I love about Deadlands is that you have basically a cinematic Western thing, right? We've got, you know, zombies and six shooters. And the system is so perfectly captures what with, like, you know, like you're drawing cards and using poker chips in addition to your dice rolls to make things happen.
Yeah.
It feels like, you know, you're in a dusty saloon with sawdust on the floor. I absolutely loved Deadlands.
I agree. When it comes to certain mechanical game systems for accomplishing their universe, to play the game in the universe that it was designed for, I place Deadlands as one of the tops. Deadlands is the only game I know of when people pull out handguns or, you know, any kind of gun whatsoever, everybody starts diving for cover because you die. I mean, it's not like, you know, I take 6 hit points off of my, you know, 34, you know, brush, who cares? This is that, you know, they blow your head off. They shoot your arms out and incapacitate you.
And having waded into at least one Deadlands firefight before I realized that and using a stack of poker chips about a meter high to get out of it. I know exactly what you're talking about. But, you know, Deadlands does that 7C in terms
that was
of...
That was my next one. 7C is another one with the swashbuckling. I think 7C is just a marvel of mechanical design to represent its universe.
That's right. And I think he is still designing games. I think it's his company is Plaid. It's either Plaid Hat or Plaid Chameleon. And I apologize for not remembering which. But I think he's doing some indie stuff. But the guy who designed 7th C is still around. But yeah, both of those were just really great games. And in terms of the RPGs. And there's other good games out there.
I can, you know, from RPGs. RPGs is a little bit more difficult simply because, you know, various people have different criteria for what makes an RPG good. The primary thing is, to me, it's the storytelling. I'm not a hack and slash guy. Not that I don't like a good fight, but I really want to tell the story. I want to experience the world. I want to do some what by the character standards would be kind of mundane stuff as well, just to taste them, just to see how that works. And I think there's, again, like I said, I think there's some wonderful designs out there. I think Shadowrun has wonderful mechanical designs to portray their universe. I think White Wolf, has some really spectacular designs to portray their universe and the storytelling system that they've created. While you may or may not like certain aspects of their storytelling, you know,
hold on a second,
obviously
Brett,
the Empire is stronger than others.
I have to interrupt just for a moment because, as you know, I'm here in Jacksonville on a contract gig. I just saw a bridal party walking down the street headed towards the beach in full gear.
I love that.
I am surrounded. I feel like Sam the Eagle sometimes. You are all weirdos. God, that's just. I'm going to close my window so I'm not distracted again. Anyways, but now which edition of Shadowrun, though, is the one that you like the mechanics better? Because there was Third Edition, which was around really for a long time, and would be regarded, I guess, as classic Shadowrun kind of at this point. And then the new Fourth Edition, which kept a lot of the flavor, but really kind of streamlined some of the Mesa six-siders.
You know, I'm careful because I like the evolutionary statements of that. You know, one of the things I like about Shadowrun was that it was originally designed in the 1980s, 1990s. Mm-hmm. You know, it was designed around what was very high-tech concepts at the time. You know, the whole new computer hacking industry had just come out, and you know, the idea of the anti-hero as the party was kind of a newer thing, you know, wasn't exactly brand new, but it was a newer thing to portray. You know, it was always fun to try to hedge around the fact that, you know, basically you're playing criminals when you're trying to explain this to moms and dads. But what I liked is how the game continually mechanically evolved along with its universal evolution, which is why I like the new fourth edition a lot, because I think it's really cool with the, you know, everybody finally being remote, computer-wise, everybody's constantly involved in the Ethernet and, you know, being able to interact with it and stuff like that. There are technomages now who, you know, specifically are out there to mess over your ability to interact with that. That they finally fixed one of what I always thought was the chief problems of the game, which is, you know, there was the Deckers who had to go play their game when they went to do it, and everybody else participated in a different game, which I thought that was finally resolved very nicely. But again, I like I say, for portraying the universe, I thought it did a really good job portraying the universe. And I'm not necessarily a hardcore fan of one mechanical system over another. My basic premise has always been, I want a game system that doesn't interfere with the game. You know, yes. That you just, it's there to accomplish the things you can't do in the, you know, the ROLL part of the game is there to complement the ROLE game.
Yes, I would agree to the, however, I do like slightly more detail in a role-playing system than a lot of the ROLE players. So for instance, our friend Ivan would happily sit around a table and spin tails with no dice at all, whereas I would like a little bit of dice to kind of ground it, I guess, a little bit more. But I want to move on a little bit to now here's a game that, Rhett, you are going to laugh yourself silly when I say this is one of my favorite games. I think I played one game of it because I couldn't find anybody in my group to play. I loved the universe. I thought the mechanics could use a little bit. I thought the universe could use a little bit of polish. I absolutely loved the idea of Crimson Skies.
Yeah, I'm not gonna laugh. I love these
weird science airplanes flying around the United States. This thing, I absolutely love the setting.
No, I think the setting was really cool.
And it died. I had every supplement for it and couldn't find a player in my group, and it died fairly quickly. It became a great video game success, right? But as a role-playing game, it didn't really...
Yeah, I think its chief problem is that it really is geared for people our age as opposed to a younger group. They just, you know, yeah. I try to explain one time that for people my son's age... Mm-hmm. Planes don't just not have propellers. Planes don't even have jet engines anymore. You know, they're spaceships.
Well, you know. I think there was a great quote from the guy who, remember the old Avalon Hill Merchants of Venus? Yeah. And this might be in the designer's notes on it, where he says, I wanted to capture that crazy feeling of exploration and the unknown that you had in the 16th century of the Europeans discovering the spice routes and things. And you can't do that anymore because we know the world. So I set it in space. And it's the same thing, I think, with kids today. My son, like, I grew up watching Commander Cody. Well, I've watched Commander Cody on Mystery Science Theater. But, you know, I grew up watching the Crazy Afternoon movies and the World War II movies and things like that. And that was our universe. Our kids are growing up watching CGI Transformers and all six Star Wars movies. God, right? Can you imagine? There's six Star Wars movies now. So it's a very different what they're going to be nostalgic for. Is going to be very different than what we think is nostalgic role playing or nostalgic gaming,
right? And we you know, I try to put these in perspectives a lot of times. When I was growing up as a kid, I was about as far away from World War II as the kids that are growing up right now are from the first Gulf War.
Yeah, I was gonna, okay. See, I was a little further from World War II, but I was going to say To my son, the Falklands are a little dot on the map. You know, they raise sheep. I remember gaming the Falklands conflict. You know, because it was cool.
I mean, and you know, I won't even go into it other than to say, not only do I have, you know, relatives who served in Vietnam, but I have friends and, you know, friends of friends who, you know, have served in Afghanistan and Iraq and so on and so forth. Now my kids are, you know, the ones that are out there doing the job.
Yeah.
But again, it's, you know, how does that set up as far as a game is concerned. And frankly, a good game is a good game. Right. And it's just really, it's yeah. really strange because when you look at game mechanisms, there's a lot of abstractions a lot of times. One of the great things I love about what seems to be the excitement factor is the fictional hook. Mm-hmm. You know, that there was, I cannot remember the original game mechanisms for Small World, the abstract game that Small World was. Vinci, which was very poorly received because people just couldn't relate to it. Yes. Turned into Small World and people fell in love with the game.
Exactly. Much better. Yeah, exactly. And Vinci was set, it was a stylized map of Europe, but it wasn't at all historically accurate. Right. And so it drove me a little batty. And yet when this basically the same system retooled graphically, and with a couple of tweaks, but not many, as Small World, I absolutely fell in love with it. So you're right. So the fictional hook is important. And I've been wanting to say this for the last couple of minutes. I'm thinking about it because I was playing Mad Zeppelin with my kids. I'm a sucker for anything steampunk.
Yeah.
I have Space 1889 supplements. I've read them. I've never even considered playing Space 1889, but I bought the supplements. I even bought the audio CDs of like the audio, like the radio, you know, versions of Space 1889 adventures. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, love steampunk.
You and I both are very much into Victorian sci-fi. You know, I think Jules Verne's a phenomenal writer. I can go on and on about, you know, great science fiction writers that existed before 1930. But the big thing that I think is also interesting about that is, where I tend to have a lot of leeway towards, let's call it modern science fiction, anything that were to be future things, mm-hmm. I just go absolutely, you know, broken over when they mess with history in such a way that I go, that doesn't even make sense, messing with this. Dystopian Wars. I think Dystopian Wars is a beautiful looking game. Mm-hmm. Mechanically speaking, I haven't really looked at it. I noticed that it's got some interesting changes that they've done on the rest of the Spartan game system. It's another evolution of the Spartan game system, which I think is a very nice game system. But their background history to America just, you know, sits there and has me pounding my head into the ground. You know, the idea that the Confederacy not only won the Civil War, but took over the Union, that... You know, and they used.
I know how that must gall you, because every time we talk about this, yeah, okay, all right, I can see that.
Equally so, it's because of, you know, the technology that they've given the Americans, which is like side wheelers, as opposed to, you know, everybody else who uses propeller driven vessels. It was like, does it really require that much research to realize, you know, that most modern naval innovation was done during the American Civil War?
Yeah. You know what I wanted to, speaking of history that galls me and steampunk and games that I love that flopped, Castle Falkenstein.
Oh, yeah.
The system was a bit of a dud, right? With the, cause the idea was that the Victorian era, oh my gosh, they didn't use dice. That was for ruffians. So you used cards for everything and the system had its flaws, but the universe was beautiful, except for that gash in Europe. They created a sea that went down to Bavaria so that Bavaria could be a naval power. And that was the little bit of history that bugged me on it. But in terms of a fully created world and a game that I've gone back to and read the fiction and read the rules over and over and over, and that would be Castle Falkenstein.
So. Yeah, I like that a lot. And, you know, we were talking about RPGs and stuff again. You know, slipping back into that for a moment. Mm-hmm. Couple that I left out. One of my absolute favorites, Call of Cthulhu. Cthulhu is unlike every other RPG I've ever played. Talk about a game that's not hack and slash. You know, the monsters show up in Cthulhu and the answer is run as fast as you can. Yes. Trip one person so they're eaten and you can get away. You know, a really cool game and usually a very cerebral game. I also like the setting. I'm a big fan of the 20s and 30s, though. I'm more of the film noir logic behind that. You know, I would much rather have the Humphrey Bogart characters out there and along those styles of, you know, two-fisted mm-hmm. gangs. The other big one that, you know, I'm absolutely a fan over, and if Greg Stafford ever listens to this, he absolutely knows it. I'm a RuneQuest freak. It broke all the rules for every other game. The universe to me was just so well thought out.
Now that one's come back into print, hasn't it? Didn't somebody?
Yeah, Mongoose has the production.
Did they
do the
fighting duck thing?
They still have ducks. Ducks are still there. Okay. The problem with this one that I have is it's not in the same age. It's okay. In the preceding age.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and to me, that's why it may not be bad for new players getting into it. I'm a third age fan. I'm the classic superheroes empires clashing system that was the original RuneQuest.
All right. Well, Rhett, let's wrap it up. We just hit about an hour, or we're about to hit an hour on the show.
Yeah, we could go on forever.
Oh, we haven't talked about things like Empire Builder and all the other games that we played that we love. And, like I said, there are so many. But just once, I wanted our listeners to hear us talk about games with affection and not get in little digs, about how they were made or who made them or whatever, or, talking about the money side of things. But just the genuine affection that anyone in this industry has for the games, that's why we're here. And I know that's why you guys are listening. And I'm sure that there'll be everyone is going to send us in letters this week. So, Rhett, tell everybody how they can send in their feedback and tell us what their favorite games are and why they're in the game industry or would like to or what their favorite game was. I'm sure everybody's got a good story. So how can they get in touch with us?
I'm sure everybody's got one, yes. Well, you can email us.
Just don't start any stories with, and then my character. Rhett and I have done that enough. Thank you very much. All right, Rhett.
Oh, that was a cheap shot.
It was.
Okay. Anyway, folks, you can email us at papermoney@thepurplepawn.com. You can Skype us at Paper Money Podcast, or you can phone us at 773-634-9377.
And you can check out our RSS feed, purplepawn.com/category/papermoney/feed. That's just the Paper Money shows to segregate those out from all the news pouring out of the Purple Pawn, so you won't lose track of the Paper Money shows. And if you want to get us on Skype, God bless you if you can get through their new interface. They updated the interface. I think it looks terrible. I'm a Mac user, so maybe the PC one is not as bad, but ugh. Anyways, Rhett, I don't think we have – there's not a ton of upcoming stuff, and part of that our next show is – when is our next show?
Our next show is
– there it is. It's in the show notes. May 8th. Once again, I will most likely be on the road for this show because my long nightmare of the soul in Jacksonville is almost over. Just as the water gets warm enough that people who are not from Wisconsin will go in it, just as all the beautiful women in bikinis are starting to show up on the weekends, I am going back to West Michigan.
Well, in a few weeks, the water and temperatures will have warmed up enough that people will be out of their snow gear.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty soon, we're very excited in West Michigan. It's almost wetsuit weather. Oh, I digress. Anyways, so Rhett, our next show is May 8th. I might be on the road, so again, like this one, it might be a day or two late. Again, love talking about games. I'm not sure what we're going to talk about that week, especially if I'm on the road, but you can rest assured we'll have something to say.
Well, that's it for this show. I'm Rhett Kipp.
And I'm Ben Clark.